political freedom, and it was all about immorality and a lust for blood, and they really made a shambles of William Wallace's life in that movie. So there you go. You don't need to watch it. If you haven't seen it, don't bother. I just told you what it's all about. Yeah, read about it. Read about it. Read the stories. They're a whole lot better. G.A. Henty, actually, if you look him up, he's a late 19th century author, writes some really good historical fictions. So he'll create some young character, usually a young boy that's just starting out in life, and he somehow gets attached to great characters of history. So he writes one about William Wallace and Robert de Bruce. He writes one about Richard the Lionhearted. Writes another about a young boy that goes off into the Rocky Mountains when before everything had been explored and gets trapped by Indians up in the mountains and has to survive up there for all winter. Lots of fun stuff. G.A. Henty. I like it. Kids, not so much. Anyway, so chapter 10, after this. Now, remember, chapter 9 was David's kindness to Mephibosheth. He searched out the last remaining relative of Saul in order to fulfill his promise to Jonathan, who died some 20 years before this. And so David fulfilled that vow to Jonathan. And now after this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. We in America have been blessed with 200 and almost 50 years of very peaceful, very smooth transitions of power. Every 4 years, we elect another president. And we have yet to have a major revolt or a major incident over that, aside from perhaps the lawsuits that came out of, what was that, the 2000 presidential election, where they said, I don't know if all those votes were counted properly. But aside from a little ripple there, everything's been pretty good. We haven't had any states rise up and say, nope, 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 we didn't elect him, we're not following him, and go into civil war because of it. However, in the ancient world, transitions of power were much less frequent. They didn't happen by election. They didn't happen every 4 years. They happened about once a generation when the king died for some reason, whether he died peacefully or whether he was assassinated. If he was assassinated and a new and a coup was coming in trying to set up a new dynasty or a new regime, that'd be a very difficult and turbulent time for that country. Even if the king died of natural causes and his son ascended to the throne, it was a little bit of a turbulent time because you're just never quite sure if everybody in the kingdom is going to follow this new king, especially if he's a really young king. Okay? So you've got a pretty turbulent time with the Ammonites here, and we think we see a little bit of this in our country when we have a transition from one president to the next, what our new foreign policy is going to be. How are we going to be treating other nations? What's our relationship with them going to be like based on the personality of our new leader? Well, they have the same issues back then, and that's going to come to play here with Hanun coming into power in the place of his father. David said, I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. This is about the only reference we get in Scripture as to any kind of relationship between David and the Ammonites and what's going on with them. Now, if we look back to chapter 8, we will read about some of the battles that David had with other kings. Verse 11 says, chapter 8, verse 11, these also King David dedicated to the Lord together with the silver and gold that he dedicated from all the nations he subdued, Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, Amalek. So at some point, things changed between Israel's relationship with the Ammonites. In the beginning, it must have been pretty good because David recognizes that Hanun's father was loyal to David and didn't cause any trouble with Israel. And so when that man died, David sent an entourage of his servants to basically to pay his respects to Hanun, the new king. And so he says, look, he dealt loyal with me, so I'm going to deal loyally with him. And he sends this entourage, and undoubtedly it would have come with gifts. Because, you know, the old thing. It's not so much true anymore, but you don't go to somebody's house without bringing a box of cookies or something, right? Okay, you bring a house gift. And so they did the same thing. So probably a very large, elaborate gift went with these men. And David is trying to reaffirm to the new king that he wants a relationship between Israel and the Ammonites, and he wants it to be a good one. And so he sends this entourage of people. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. Now, to remind ourselves of where we're looking here, if I can find the cursor on my screen, it seems to have disappeared. Yeah, I'm waving it around and I don't see it. Wow. Well, let's try this. Aha! That's why my computer has locked up. There we go. Well, you guys don't have anything either. Tim, let me see the clicker thing. Yeah, you have the map up there, so we're going to do this the old-fashioned way with a laser pointer. Okay. Which button's the laser pointer? Oh, I got to turn it on. Yeah. Right in my eye. Okay. There we go. All right. So you can see all this conglomeration of names over here on the west side of the Dead Sea. This is Judah. And Ephraim up here to the north. You can see Hebron here where David began ruling over Judah. And then he moved it up to Jerusalem, which is right in this area. The Ammonites dwell in this land just north of Moab. Moab is over here. And the Ammonites lived here. And so this is where David is sending this entourage of people, is over here. We learn there's a parallel passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 19 that gives this same account, almost with exactly the same wording. And they tell us, they add one detail, that the chief city of Ammon at the time was this city called Medeba. And so that's where David is sending these men. So David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites, and they come to the chief city. But that little three-letter word, you see how important this thing is? It can tell you a whole lot. Because what has David been saying he's going to do? I'm going to deal loyally with Hanun. But. So you know there's going to be a big contrast between how David's feeling about things and how the new king is going to be feeling about things. But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun their lord, "Do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father?" And what is the answer they're trying to draw out of him? Yeah. Probably not. Well, they're asking it in a way that's accusing, isn't it? You don't usually say, "Do you think?" if the answer is going to be affirmative. Okay? So they're trying to draw a negative answer out of him. They're trying to lean him towards their point of view. Here's what they think. "Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city and to spy it and to overthrow it?" Why might they be thinking that? They don't like David? Why might they not like David? What's David been doing for 20 years? Fighting, okay? David conquered the Philistines over here. He conquered the Amalekites down here. He's going to conquer Edom. He's conquered Moab. He's conquered the Amorites. David has been at war for 20 years. And so now this entourage shows up in their chief city, and so they are thinking, wait a second, what's going on here? David's trying to find out our weaknesses. He hasn't actually come to show us that he's being friendly. And so they convince Hanun that this is the case. So Hanun took David's servants. Now, you just have to think of what would happen in our day if some of our ambassadors were treated this way. Okay. Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at the hips and sent them away. Cut it off from here over. Okay. So they take, somehow forcefully shave off half their beard. Now, I can understand the problem with this. Some of you might say, good, he finally got shaven, clean-faced, right? But you got to remember that the Jews always wore full beards. They didn't even trim them like I trim mine. They let it grow. I had a pastor in West Virginia saw me with my beard, and he just had this big, bushy, white beard, and he just said, let it grow, man, let it grow. Because the beard to the Jewish man was the quintessential symbol of manhood. If you could grow a beard, you were a man. Guys, how old were you when you started shaving? Now, wasn't that a pretty symbolic moment for you? Say, I'm finally man enough to grow a beard, you know? So when you're a teenager, you look in the mirror every day and wait, is that one? Oh, no, it's just a dirt, right? Am I getting whiskers yet? We had Peter at the dinner table the other day looking around to see if he had any whiskers growing. And he said to say, sorry, not yet, bud. Pretty soon, right? Yeah, you'll get it. I was in my early 20s before I could even grow a beard. And so that's why as soon as I was able, I'm like, yeah, bring it on. Let's have it. So I grew my beard out. So to have half the beard shaved, now today we carve our beards into all sorts of funny shapes. They wouldn't have done that. It was an extreme shame. It would be akin to taking a lady who had very long hair and just shaving half her head off, because it was a symbol of masculinity. And not only that, but then they take the robe that the men wore, which they didn't wear two-piece outfits like we do with a shirt and with a pants. They wore one long robe, and then they cut it in half so that you're exposed and your undergarments are showing. If they wore any, it was kind of, you know, up in the air as to whether they did. It might have been like the Scotsman and their kilts, okay? So, but you can understand there with that picture, there's the shame of how Hanun has treated David's emissaries. He has shamed them by shaving off the symbol of their masculinity, and he shamed them by exposing them to everybody, and he just sets them outside the gates of the city and locks the doors. So what are they supposed to do? You're just standing here, completely exposed and humiliated, so they got nothing, they just got to walk back. And probably orders went out to every merchant between Medeba and Israel, don't you dare sell these people a new pair of clothes. Okay. And most likely you didn't have to have orders go out, because if you saw that your king had shamed somebody, you didn't dare interfere with that. So they have to walk back. And they send messengers to David. Verse 5, when it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And again, this is, we can kind of understand the part about, you know, having yourself uncovered and having to walk around in public, but even the shame of having your beard shaved off halfway was huge. And so David hears about it, so he sends messengers back to them. The king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. Because buying a new set of clothes at Jericho was pretty easy to do. Any JCPenney's on the corner at Jericho would have a new robe for you. And so you can just go in and you can finish off that part of the embarrassment by just buying a new set of robes. But having your beard regrow, it takes a while. So these men have been humiliated, and the humiliation is such that David doesn't even want them coming back to the royal court at Jerusalem until they can present themselves with the full show of their masculinity again. And he said, don't come back here until you've got your beard grown again. So it was a shame not only in Ammon, but it was also a shame for them to have to come back to Israel that way. And David tells them, just stay there. And then when it regrows, you can come back. So, verse 6, when the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David. I don't understand why they're surprised about this. What else did you think was going to happen? How did you think David was going to respond to this? Didn't seem like there was a whole lot of forethought that went into that action. But when they saw they became a stench to David, the Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. Where's my pointer? Did I give it to you, or I said it right here? So, since we can't zoom out or anything, we're a little limited, but those kingdoms, Syria is way up here to the north. If the Sea of Galilee is right there, then Syria is up here. The Euphrates River flows down this way, and Syria is right up there by it with Damascus. Just to the southeast of Syria is Tob, over here bordering the land of Galilee. So there's Tob, and that's, we're not really sure where Maacah comes from. But they hire this coalition of armies, and in our parallel passage in 1 Chronicles, we're told they pay out 1,000 talents of silver, a huge, huge amount of money to gather all these people together and to try and defend themselves. You would think that if you're going to embarrass a mighty nation's king and ambassadors, you would make sure you had the troops to defeat him first before you'd take that step, wouldn't you? But apparently they didn't. So when they find out David's angry, that's when they send out and say, we'd better hire some people to help us out because we don't have enough. And so he gathers together this army, 20,000 plus 1,000. So we've got about 33,000 men and chariots and foot soldiers and horsemen. And verse 7, when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. So here David is responding. So if you see the armies gathering here in Ammon, they're just a few miles from the border of Israel. That's time to start putting defenses up. And that's time to take the initiative and say, well, they're not just planning a cookout. We're going to have to do something about this. So David gathers the mighty men of Israel, and he sends them out to meet this threat. And verse 8, the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. So here's the setup. When David's men come back to Medeba with their army, and you got to understand, David is going to level the place if he can take it. So all the men from Ammon are mustered. So they would send riders out in every direction, and all the fighting men from the whole country would come towards the chief city, and they'd take up residence there and they'd guard it. So this city has swelled in population with troops, with fighting men. So it's going to be very difficult for David to take the city in the first place. So Joab lines up his men, and they're facing the city, and they're going to start preparing their siege attack. And these sieges could last for a long time. The siege of Samaria in 722, when the Assyrians came down to defeat the northern tribes of Israel, the siege of Samaria lasted for 2 years. Basically, if you would look at the city and say, wow, those are some really tall towers, they're really thick walls, it's going to be hard for us to get through there. I mean, if we go up and knock on the door, they're just going to throw rocks down on us, they're going to shoot arrows and pour boiling oil on us, and we're just going to stand here and get slaughtered. That's not a good idea. So we can either build catapults and trebuchets and battering rams and make an all-out assault, or we surround the city, we stop the flow of every possible good from going into it that we can, so there's no food coming into the city, no goods going out of the city, and we just bottle them up until they starve to death or until they come out. In fact, most of the time that's what would happen. So when you read in the historical books about the siege of Jerusalem, and it talks about a donkey's head being sold for several days' wages, that's what's happening. Food is so scarce that people are eating anything they can get their hands on. How many of you serve donkey's head at your Easter dinner? It's not really a delicacy, I don't think. but we also read a couple of passages in Scripture about bird's dung being sold because at least it fills your belly, right? It makes the hunger pains go away. Or women eating their children because the siege has been going on so long, there is nothing left to eat. And people are going nuts just sitting there, okay? And so there's one of the tactics, and probably that's what David's planning on doing, or Joab is planning on doing. He gets to Medeba, and he aligns up his troops in battle array, and while they're considering, do we go for a full frontal attack and try and tear the gates down and gain entrance to the city, or do we just surround the city and wait it out for a while? That's when they realize they've been surrounded. Because while the Ammonites are in the city, their friends have gathered outside the city on the other side of Joab and his men. So the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate, and the Syrians of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. So we're not told how many Ammonites are in the city, but they start coming out the front gate. And they spread out to the sides and they draw themselves up in battle array. And battles back then were much more personal encounters than they are now. You know, we can blow things up from hundreds of miles away with missiles and drop bombs from 30,000 feet, and you never see your opponent. Even the guns we have can shoot for more than a mile, so you might not ever see the guy that you're attacking. Well, that doesn't happen when you're using swords and spears. You've got to be at pretty close range. And so while these days the object of a battle is spread yourselves out so that if a bomb lands in the middle of you, you don't blow up 400 guys at one time. Back then, the answer was, you stay all together in a straight line. We're going to keep marching forward, and anybody in front of us gets run through. Okay. So, the bad guys, can tell I'm biased, don't you? The bad guys, the Ammonites, come out of the city and they start spreading out to each side, and they're facing Joab and his army head on. And they're getting themselves ready to go. So typically you'd have your spearmen in the front because they got these long poles with spikes on the end. And that way if you try to charge up, you can't get anywhere near them. And then behind them would be the swordsmen. So that once the spearmen were engaged, the swordsmen would run through and start fighting hand to hand. And behind them were the archers. Because as the enemy's charging at you, you just start throwing arrows into them and you try to take out as many as you can. And behind that, you would have the horsemen who would go off to the sides and try and run flank around. So the Ammonites come out of the city, they're spreading out, they're getting themselves into a battle array at the entrance of the gate, and Joab is there with his men, and they're getting in their formations, and behind them start lining up the hired troops, the friends of the Ammonites, 33,000 men behind Joab. Who knows, one of the biggest mistakes that Hitler made in World War II. Two fronts. He attacked Russia. Why is that a bad idea? Because it's almost impossible to fight a war on two fronts. We struggled with it in World War II, fighting in both the European theater and in the Pacific theater. That was a strain on the American military and economy to put out enough supplies for both fronts. Okay. That's actually was a huge frustration to Eisenhower, because so much material was going toward the Pacific front to build the ships and supply the troops necessary for those campaigns that it delayed his desire to invade Fortress Europe. Gave Hitler a lot of time to dig in and make better fortifications. But Hitler, when he attacked Russia, put himself in a two-front war, and ultimately was one of the reasons we were able to defeat him, because he consumed so many resources trying to fight the Russians that he couldn't defend himself adequately against us when we invaded. So God was in the whole thing. Worked out the way that he wanted it. So here's Joab now faced with a two-front battle. He's got bad guys in front of him, get bad guys behind him. What's he going to do? We don't know how many men in front of him. Doesn't tell us how many Ammonites there are, but we know there's 33,000 men behind him. So you can imagine, you're pulling out your sword, putting your armor on, you turn around, and there's 33,000 bad guys behind you. That's a bad position to be in. So when Joab saw that the battle was against him, both in front and in the rear, here's his solution. He chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The Syrians are the ones behind him. Ammonites are the ones in the city. Verse 10, so the rest of his men he put in charge of Abishai, his brother, and arrayed them against the Ammonites. So here's his plan. The best guys, small group, but good fighters. You're coming with me. We're going to go defend the rear of the army from the Syrians. Abishai, you're taking the rest of the army, attacking the front. So he's going to split himself. The most highly trained warriors, the most battle-hardened people, they're going with Joab to fight in the open field against the Syrians. Abishai, his brother, is going against, with the bulk of the Israelite army, is going against the city and the Ammonites. All right. So he said, verse 11, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come to help you." And here he gives his rallying speech in verse 12. "Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him." So Joab, in the past and in the future as well, has not been the kind of guy that we are really looking up to all that much. But he at least does have some confidence in God's sovereign control of things. And so he's willing to say, all right, just fight hard and let's see what God does. He's seen David conquer impossible odds enough times to know that the battle doesn't belong to the person that has the best weapons or the biggest number of troops. The battle belongs to the one that God decides is going to win. And so there's his encouragement speech. Just be courageous, fight hard, and see what God does. Verse 13, "So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians. And very anticlimactically, we're just told, don't know how long the battle goes on, don't know how fiercely it raged, but the Syrians flee. 33,000 men flee before these Israelites. They fled before him." That is, the Syrians flee before Joab. Must have been a pretty fierce onslaught that those men put on. "And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city." So this divided tactic actually worked in this case. So that when Joab started pushing back the Syrians, and the Ammonites saw that their hired help was fleeing and running away from the battle, they said, we got no hope now. If that small force with Joab could defeat 33,000 people, what's a united force of Israelites going to do against us? We're dead. Get back in the city before they kill us all. And so they run back in the city, slam the gates, they all get up on the walls, draw their bows and arrows, and get ready to fight some more. Israel wins the day. So when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. We're not told why he doesn't press the battle against the city. It's possible that he took some pretty heavy casualties and needed to regroup his men. It's possible that the time of year was getting too late to endure a long siege. There's a lot of reasons he could have went back. But whatever it was, Joab decided now is not the time to besiege Medeba. We've got to go home and get ready. We've got to go home and regroup. And so he takes the armies back to Jerusalem. This causes a problem. Now, the Ammonites are going to take a back seat in this whole story until chapter 11. Which we saw at the beginning, that's David is going to send Joab back to Ammon to try and completely defeat it. All right, but for the present, the problem is no longer the Ammonites, now the problem is the Syrians. Because, verse 15, "When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. And Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates, and they came to Helam with Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadadezer at their head." So, going back to our map, again, Syria up here to the north, and actually a lot of tribes that are called Syrians throughout Scripture. You have Syrians of Damascus, you have some Syrians that are a little bit to the west, you've got Syrians across the Euphrates. So if our Euphrates River is flowing down this way, here's Damascus, and this is where Hadadezer is from. There's also some Syrians here, and there's some Syrians across the river to the northeast. So Hadadezer gathers all of these neighboring Syrian kingdoms together to fight in a coalition against David. This could be bad news. And so Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam with Shobach. They've even got this champion at the head of the army. He's the commander of the army of Hadadezer. Verse 17, when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan. So now David has not just sent out the mighty men. Now he's gathered the entire army of Israel. Because when he sent Joab over to Medeba, it was just with the mighty men. That's just the chief of his army. So you can understand, when Joab has to divide his forces, he's taking the best of the best with him to fight against the Syrians. Didn't hurt him at all to have those quality troops there. But now David's gathering the entire army of Israel, which would be, he'd send out messengers to every village, and every family had to contribute a man. And so this is the militia of Israel. This is every family sending fighting men into the battle. They crossed the Jordan and came to Helam, and the Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him. And the result, again, given in verse 18, very succinctly, the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Shobach, the commander of their army, so that he died there. The end of this battle is just simply that David completely destroys the Syrian army. This Syrian coalition is completely wiped out, and their leader is killed. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Amorites or the Ammonites anymore. Here's how this works out. So David's got a plan to go and comfort the son of his friend, who turns on him, belittles and humiliates his servants, and then gathers an army to fight against him. You ever had a day felt like that? You start off thinking this is going to be a pretty good day, and then, bam, everything explodes. Nothing goes right, and you're saying to yourself, I just want to go back to bed, start over. It has to be better tomorrow. And then you wake up tomorrow, and guess what? It's not any better. David wins one battle with the Syrians, and he comes back home, and Joab wins the battle and comes home, and now they've got this massive army of Syrians and a whole bunch of kings gathering together to come and destroy Israel. So David does what a king is supposed to do. He gathers his army and goes off to defend his country. But you see God at work in the middle of all of these things, because through the Ammonites calling for help, which probably wasn't David's plan in this battle, now David has an opportunity to extend his kingdom even farther, probably farther than he was thinking it would ever go. Because once David defeats Hadadezer, and he puts garrisons, we know this from back in chapter 8, he puts garrisons in the cities of Damascus and several other Syrian cities. So David's empire is stretching all the way from the bottom of the Dead Sea up to the river Euphrates. Israel is the superpower of the world. David has, because of these battles that he wasn't probably counting on, but he wasn't afraid to go and meet what challenges God set in his path, God opened up some amazing doors for David. And David was able to extend the influence of Israel all the way north to the Euphrates River, and all these countries are sending tribute to Israel. Is God in control? Three words you want to always remember. I mean, there's a whole lot of words you want to remember, otherwise it's really hard to communicate. The three words you really want to remember: God's got this. If you forget everything else, remember that. God's got this. So when the car blows up, or the stove burns the cookies, or you get that horrible news, whatever it is, God's got this. You don't know what opportunities God's opening up. You might never see Him this side of glory, but like we talked about this morning, God has an eternal purpose and plan. He declares the end from the beginning. And God's purposes from before the creation of the world were to establish David as the mightiest kingdom in the world at the time so that David could be an example, a type of the Lord Jesus and what he's going to be. What David did in a small way, the Lord Jesus is going to do in a perfect way. You say, ruling over everything from Egypt to the Euphrates is small? Not really. But that's the greatness of God. Okay? God looks at that and says, yeah, that's a small example of what my son is going to do. So when those difficulties in life come up, we talked about this in Sunday school this morning, count it all joy. Because you know at the very least what God's trying to accomplish is growing your faith. That's the very least. And that's something precious. We'll see in eternity the great things that he's going to do. And we might not have any idea how those events influence. Like we were talking about sharing Christ with people. You never know. All those kids you shared the gospel with in kids club and in vacation Bible school. How many of them are following the Lord faithfully today? You don't always know. Because you lose track of people. It's just not possible to keep track of everybody you get connected with. But if you look at every opportunity that God brings you, someone else's life is exploding and you have an opportunity to speak an encouraging word to them, you just don't know what God is accomplishing through you to maybe those four words you said to them were what carried them through that trial so that they didn't give up. And we'll find out in eternity what that great tapestry looks like, right? When all those threads are put together and we can finally step back and see everything that God wove together. And that's when we'll all say, praise God from whom all blessings flow. So David's got some opportunities here to see God working in the midst of trial and tribulation. To see God's mighty hand holding him up. He's seen it his whole life. Unfortunately, next week we'll have a harder lesson. Go ahead, Gene. Yeah. No. No. The city of Rome did not even exist yet. Rome was founded right about 700 B.C. We are right now looking at about 1020 B.C.